was walking down the street in the town where I was born. I was moving to a beat that I never felt before. So I opened up my eyes and I took a look around. I saw you written across the sky.
Of the Earth. It's the Enviro Show on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an aeroplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world, serve its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up, an ox beat, grunt, no strength. Clatter with fear, fight down high. Fire and a fire representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Let the West coming in a hurry with the Furies breathing down your neck. Team my team reporters babble Trump, tether crop. Look at that, no plane, fine, then. Uh-oh, overflow, population common food, but it'll do. Save yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs, listen to your heartbeat. Dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right. Right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam fight, bright light. Feeling pretty sight. Of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. 6 o'clock, TV hour, don't get caught in foreign tower, slice and burn, return, listen to yourself, churn, lock it in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate, automotive, incinerate, light a candle, light a motor, step down. Watching heel crush, crush, uh-oh. This means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear. A tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine. Yeah. took to Biden Mountain, said in a line, Leonard Bernstein, Leonard Brasnap, Lenny Bruce, and Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, symbiotic, patriotic, slam, but nap, right?
Right.
It's the end.
Welcome. It's the Enviro back to the Pleistocene show. Jean's back, but she's back from Portugal, but now she's in Jean Town. So she won't be with us tonight. Maybe next time around. One of our favorite local wildlife biologists, Jenna Seavey, returns to talk about, well, bringing back the mastodons.
Back to the Pleistocene. Indeed. Hello, this is Glenn Ayers.
And this is Dio. And we'll also check out maybe the latest from the usual suspects at Wild Earth and some interesting wildlife corridor news on Turtle Island. You never heard of Turtle Island? You're living on it.
You know that story about the native wise woman who was asked at some kind of conference, you know, about how the native belief went with the turtles. And she explained that the earth was being supported on turtles, or on a turtle. The person asked her, well, yeah, but what's supporting that turtle? And she said, well, another turtle. And he said, well, yes, but what's supporting that turtle? She said, another turtle. And he said, but what's supporting that turtle? She said, another turtle. And he said, but what's supporting that turtle? And she said, you know, you just don't get it. It's turtles all the way down.
All right, well, speaking of critters, it's the revenge of the critters once again. This week, Bambi attacks. Bambi attacks. This is from the New York Times. Confrontations with deer lead to campus safety campaign. Carbondale, Illinois. 7 people were threatened or injured by female deer last year on the Southern Illinois University campus, and the confrontations have prompted the university to wage a safety campaign looking ahead to the spring's fawning season. The incidents have been attributed to the doe's protective motherly instincts, their squeezed habitat, and in some cases, too much human curiosity. Quote, before last year, no one really had heard of this sort of thing, said Clay Nielsen, a wildlife ecologist at the university. Mr. Nielsen said he believes different deer were responsible for the 3 attacks that sent 4 people to the hospital, mostly with minor injuries. It wasn't like one crazy animal, he said, but some of the attacks may have been avoided, he noted, if the victims had not moved towards the fawn to pet it. All right, we'll throw this into the Revenge of the Critters. You may recall in our last show we spoke about Mr. Zach over there at the Mohawk Trout Hatchery.
Yeah, and revenge would be something.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and his cohort, Timothy Lloyd. Actually, it's Michael Zach Jr., 58, of 467 Amherst Road, Sunderland.
That's Route 116.
And his...
Next to the Laurinaitis vegetable fruit zero, flower stand.
Phone number 413-665-2888. And his employee, Timothy Lloyd, 29 of 115 Park Street, East Hampton. All this has been in the newspapers, folks. These are the guys that killed scores of birds, including listed species, a bald eagle, osprey, a red-tailed hawk.
Over 250 great blue heron.
In today's Gazette, there's a story. Facing charges, 2 men await disposition of case. Michael Zach Jr. and his employee, Timothy Lloyd, were arrested May 11th on the warrant for allegedly violating the Migratory Bird Treaty Act by shooting protected birds at Zach's Trout Hatchery in Sunderland. Zach and Lloyd made an initial appearance in federal court May 11th, during which a judge explained the nature of the charges they face and discussed the conditions of their release. They were released in their own personal recognizance. The two men are due back in court this Thursday, for a probable cause hearing to determine whether there is sufficient evidence to go forward with the complaint against them. That court date will be canceled, however, if Zach and Lloyd are indicted by a grand jury before then. They will be arraigned after an indictment is issued or after the June 1 hearing. They could face additional charges such as violation of the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection and Endangered Species Acts. Assistant U.S. Attorney Nadine Pellegrini, who will be prosecuting the case in federal court, declined to discuss whether her office will seek further charges. That's it for Revenge of the Critters.
Yeah, that was a bad week for revenge, I guess.
Yeah. Let's get into some serious bush bashing. It's time for our traditional bush bashing, and we'll lead into that with one of Neil Young's latest out of Living with War, is it?
It's, yeah.
Yeah. After the Garden is Gone. It's very thematic. Okay, that's Neil Young, and you can go to his website, neilyoung.com, and download the whole album.
It's a stream. You can stream it, but I downloaded this off of BitTorrent.
the quality isn't all that great on the website, but yeah. It's free.
Yeah, you can listen to all the songs in sequence.
All right. Well, Neil brought us up to the neocon crash and burn watch, and a study commissioned by the Bush regime concluded just the other day that the lower atmosphere was indeed growing warmer, and that there was, quote, clear evidence of human influence on the climate system. The climate system, what? No rewrite.
What?
New York Times, May 3rd. A scientific study commissioned by the Bush administration concluded yesterday that the lower atmosphere was indeed growing warmer. The finding eliminates a significant area of uncertainty in the debate over global warming, one that the administration has long cited as a rationale for proceeding cautiously on what it says would be costly limits on emissions of heat-trapping gases. The officials said while the new finding was important, the administration's policy remained focused on studying the remaining questions and using voluntary means to slow growth in the emissions of heat-trapping gases like carbon dioxide. The report's authors all agreed that the review of the data showed that the atmosphere was in fact warming in ways that generally meshed with computer simulations. The study said that the only factor that could explain measured warming of Earth's average temperature over the last 50 years was the buildup of heat-trapping gases, which are mainly emitted by burning coal and oil.
Fossil fuels.
Bush's voluntary emissions reduction program not amounting to much, and this is from GRIST, which is an excellent site. Go to www.grist.org. Are you sitting down? We've got some earth-shattering news. The Bush administration's voluntary program to reduce industrial greenhouse gas emissions aren't working.
Oh.
A report issued by the Government Accountability Office stated that many industry participants in the U.S. EPA's voluntary Climate Leaders Program and the Department of Energy's voluntary Climate Vision Program were not setting specific emissions reduction goals or inventorying or reporting on their emissions. According to the report, as of November 2005, only 38 of the 74 participants in the EPA program had set reduction goals. An EPA spokeslack responded that the program now has 87 participants, with half committed to reducing emissions.
Well, that's volunteerism, isn't it?
They're holding strong at 50%. 11 of the 15 trade groups involved in the DOE program have established targets, but only 5 have reported their emissions. Wonder why this plan isn't working? Anyone like to volunteer an opinion?
I can't think of any.
Okay, this from the dailyinterlake.com, whatever that is. House committee kills land sale proposal. They're crashing and burning all over. The worst president this country's ever had. The enemies of the earth are taking hit after hit. Representative Denny Raber, Republican of Montana, says the House Appropriations Committee has killed legislation that would have authorized a plan to sell National Forest and Bureau of Land Management lands. The program was proposed by the Bush administration as a source of revenue. The congressman said he and a coalition of lawmakers on the Appropriations Committee mainly objected to the idea because it involved selling off public trust to fund a temporary program. But Rayberg said the proposal could resurface in other legislation.
Yeah, I'm sure it will, too.
Yeah. Shall we move on to Dick Pombo, or shall we ditch him?
I'd rather ditch him.
Ditch Pombo.
Yeah.
All right, well, then let's see. We're moving up to Garth Cheney. That's right, folks. Some folks make maps of other people's oil fields, like, say, Iraq, when Darth Cheney's Energy Task Force divided up the spoils back in when? March 2001? Interesting timing.
Yeah.
And others, here's the map. See it? Can you see that, audience?
I can see it.
This is a map of
It's not
Iraq.
In color, though. I'd like to
notice there's no cities and no rivers.
What are those things
no
on
roads.
There? Oil
it's
fields?
It's all blocked off in oil fields.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. That's the map of Iraq. Well, other people make bioregional maps.
That's right, yeah. We don't need that in Iraq.
Okay. I think that Dana Lyons will bring us right up to the interview here with Jennifer. And this is Their Brains Were Small.
Whose brains?
You know, the woolly mammoths.
Oh, of course. I forgot about that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I sit in contemplation of our human situation, I often get a certain sense of pride. Our achievements are many and mighty. The evidence cannot be denied.
But my reverie is shaken, and my thoughts are always taken by the tragedy that happened long ago. When they moved through the land, beings awesome and grand,
the fabulous dinosaurs. They were creatures in a manner quite reptilian, in their unique and stylish way. And their numbers could be reckoned in the millions, but there are zero of these heroes in the world today. They had music, art, and fashion. There was dinosauric fashion, and I think they'd be enraged and mortified when they're mentioned today. It is only to say their brains were small and they died. Perhaps some asteroid that Mother Earth could not avoid became the agent of their premature demise. I've heard these things can happen, but who are we to criticize?
When we'll spend most any price to make the ultimate device that ensures the perfect global suicide? I would venture instead that the humanoid head is where the tinier brain resides.
And when we're gone, our works will start to crumble till nothing can be found. In 10 million years, some other guy will stumble on our fossils, and some expert will begin to expound some scientific study to his cockroach science buddy
how the evidence can never be denied.
They were big, dumb, and slow.
They couldn't go with the flow.
Their brains were small and they died.
And that was Dana Lyons and John Seed. Their brains were small and they died. Speaking of small brains,
yes.
I'd like to do the official countdown to the end of the infestation currently in the White House. And this is from the official backwards countdown clock. The remaining days, hours, and minutes of the Bush regime, 965 days, 8 hours, 32 minutes, and at the beep, 20 seconds. That's all we have to survive, folks. Unless, of course, let's make this more optimistic. There's always a chance for impeachment or a military coup, I'm hoping for. It's a sad thing when you have to rely on the military. But
welcome back, Jennifer.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Maybe a cheetah could take it down.
Yeah, Bush eaten by a cheetah on his ranch, because they do have a lot of game ranches down there in Texas. Maybe some escapee.
His ranch could be the Pleistocene Park.
That could be. So, we were talking about wind power on our last show, and one of the unpointed things about wind power that some people are saying, it's going to replace coal and oil. Of course, being the ultimate pessimist that I am, I know that that's not the way things work with the deregulated energy market. Yeah, they're going to put in wind turbines and things, but it's just going to be more profit. They're not going to stop burning coal, burning other things, natural gas. And, it's just going to be more energy because there's going to be more profit. And it's not going to be enough energy to really affect prices and drive the prices down. So I think what we really need, what we're really looking for is a bigger concept. And so Jennifer's here today to talk about the idea of back to the Pleistocene. But this is a legitimate concept in conservation biology.
It's not crash and burn industrial civilization.
Well, there are those people that would like to see the collapse of industrial civilization, and I count myself among them. But this is a real conservation biology concept. And Jennifer, if you'd like to explain it, this is something that makes me drool. So I'm going to try to
explain it.
The drool off of the microphone.
Okay, well, this is an idea that first came to the public's notice last summer, when Josh Donlin and 11 of his friends published a paper in Nature, very important journal in science. And among his friends are Dave Foreman, perhaps your fan, the former leader of Earth First.
We go way back, yeah.
Michael Soule, considered by many to be the father of conservation biologists. one of my heroes. And anyway, these guys all got together and proposed this idea about restoring large megafauna, a.k.a. large animals, that used to be around about 10,000 years ago back to North America. What are these animals, you say? Horses, camels, cheetahs, elephants, lions, all used to roam North America about 13,000 years ago.
That was before downtown Northampton.
A little bit.
But they probably were walking right over where we're standing right now. We were sitting.
So when they proposed this, huge controversy. Amazingly not well received among biologists. Huh. Very controversial. Despite the fact that these 12 authors are huge heavy hitters in ecology, conservation biology, what's their argument for doing this? Well, first of all, let me also say that their proposal is not to just throw cheetahs and lions out, like, as I think Josh Donlin likes to say, open the back door of the van and let some cheetahs out. They want to put it on a private ranch somewhere. Perhaps Ted Turner?
Ted Turner's ranch, yeah.
And basically make a park like the San Diego Zoo where people could go and see Pleistocene-age animals and start it that way. In fact, Ted Turner's already started doing this with the Bolson tortoise that used to be in North America is now only found in Mexico, and he started a reintroduction on his ranch.
And these are turtles like the size of a coffee table, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, huge.
Big turtles.
Huge.
Live to be... what, a couple hundred years old, more?
Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Very, very big.
Yeah.
Is the land fenced?
Oh, well, I imagine it is. I don't know the details, but also they probably don't move very fast and not considered a huge threat as opposed to the cheetahs and the lions, which people would be very afraid of. They're proposing that this ranch would be completely fenced in and so to assuage the public's fear.
Now, one of the concepts I've heard is that this concept of Pleistocene Park, which some people may think, well, is that like Jurassic Park?
Yeah, right, right.
Had some bad...
We're not talking tourist destination here, are we?
And we're also not talking dinosaurs.
No, we're not talking about dinosaurs. But some number of these Pleistocene critters were very big. Woolly mammoths,
yes.
For instance. Much bigger than the current elephants we have.
Giant sloth.
The giant Shasta ground sloth.
Yep.
Very big. I mean, they're almost the size of elephants that we have today. But a lot of those critters are extinct now.
Right. So their list of possible species to reintroduce are species that are extinct, but that we could find a replacement in Africa or Asia to bring here. So we had an American lion. That was almost twice the size of the African lion. But since that's extinct, they would bring back the African lion here as a replacement for the American lion.
And the idea is that these replacement animals would be surrogates for the ecosystem functions that are critical to maintaining an intact ecosystem.
There wouldn't be any genetic manipulation to try to resize them?
Well, some people have actually proposed that they try to bring them back from the DNA that we have,
right.
But that's sort of a longer-term issue.
Right.
Yeah, we don't have current technology
right.
to do that. But
right.
this idea of a Pleistocene Park, we do have the current
yep.
technology to do it.
And that ecological function of these species, there's a lot of great examples of how we've lost or messing up with the ecological function of our system now because of the loss of these species. And that deer story that you read earlier, there'd be a lot less college students being taken out by deer if they actually had lions and cheetahs chasing them down.
Right.
An actual predator.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some wolves. So, Jennifer, maybe you should explain who you are. I don't know if we did a good introduction so that people have some idea of, you know, you're speaking from a point of knowing something, whereas me and Dio are actually
yeah, right.
just talking out of our butts.
Just mouthing off.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a PhD candidate at UMass in natural resource conservation. Lots of years of biology research, mostly in birds, but this evolution is a great topic for all biologists, and this particular topic is very controversial among biologists, and I find that really fascinating. And it also, this topic brings up a lot of really important questions for society to think about as far as conservation. So that's why I like it.
I was on a hike Sunday afternoon and brought up the topic right away. There was a big discussion going on. One of the people hiking with us was an entomology professor from UMass, and he had read the papers, and he was pretty good at arguing for it. So I think it's an area that has a very, very intriguing concept to it. And maybe you could explain a little bit more about where some of these Pleistocene parks might be located.
Well, in that paper by Donlin et al., they are proposing Great Plains states for economic and geographic reasons. Economic because it's a depressed area where land is now cheap and people are lacking in jobs. So putting a Pleistocene park would bring tourists to the area. Wow. You could buy land cheap. And a lot of these animals, their original ranges were essentially located in that area. So it'd be kind of a win-win for the animals, the people getting that amount of land in the first place that we need to keep cheetahs and lions and elephants alive.
Now, we have to remember that even during the time of Lewis and Clark, there were enormous herds of buffalo on the Great Plains.
I just read, actually, this weekend, that Thomas Jefferson thought that Lewis and Clark were going to see Pleistocene-era animals when they went across country.
Right.
And because he was really into fossils and natural history, and he thought that somewhere out there was a big mastodon for them to encounter. Of course, they didn't. That's what he was hopeful, that they would find some of these Pleistocene animals. Yes, there were definitely more bison, but we had already lost the lions, the cheetahs, the elephants, the camels. And a lot of people think now that it's human exploitation, the overkill theory, and that's really bubbling up as a major reason why these species went extinct, because there's more evidence pointing to the fact that they actually, these large animals, survived all the glacier climate changes, ice age retreats, and so that it's either climate, disease, or human exploitation are the reasons why these large animals went extinct. And it's probably a combination of the three in some degree, but this human exploitation theory has become more and more accepted.
That would have been the humans coming onto the continent after the last ice age, 10,000, 12,000, 13,000 years ago.
Anthropologists have been mapping the sort of novel introduction of people, came across the Bering Strait there, in other places in Australia, New Zealand, other places where when people are introduced to these new areas, the flora and fauna, especially large animals, decline rapidly. Which is why a lot of people, when you talk about this Pleistocene thing and the overkill theory, well, why are there still large animals in Africa? And that's because they had a longer time together, the humans and the animals, to evolve together. Uh-huh. So they were never this new, sudden, novel thing on the landscape that could suddenly exploit and kill out these animals that weren't used to them. So it was a new thing, this predation by humans on all these large animals in North America. So they really took a hit because of it.
Is part of the controversy having to do with the tourist aspect of it? If they turn these things into parks, how are they going to be able to maintain the ecological balance if people are driving through in their cars or whatever, you know?
Well, I think there's two camps. There's the public concerns about it, just what you're saying, fear of these animals, and the farmers, fear of these animals on livestock, especially the cheetah and lion. But then there's also the scientific community who are rightly concerned about bringing species from Africa and Asia to North America to replace these species that are now extinct. These folks propose that these species are very analogous. We don't know for sure what's going to happen. There's a lot of uncertainty in introducing a new species into the environment. What niche is it going to fill, and is it going to be successful?
Yeah, this whole concept, according to my reading of it, is that it would be a process that would take more than 50 years, so that the large ungulates would be introduced into areas, and it would be studied as an experiment in biology.
Does there have to be this commercial aspect to make it feasible?
I don't think it has to be. I think it's a way for them to make it more palatable and to make it more economically feasible. I mean, Ted Turner's doing it without public part of the process, so.
Yeah.
So
it's the concept
possible.
Of doing something out on the Great Plains that would be analogous to the Serengeti, for instance, in Africa, that would be a worldwide attraction. And that is actually occurring. Maybe, Jennifer, you know more about it. It is occurring right now. There's a Pleistocene park being developed in, I think, Siberia, in Russia.
Yeah, amazing story. That was in Science, I believe, published in that journal, about this program in Siberia. It's basically came about because of concerns on global warming and the loss of the tundra in Siberia. And originally, the frozen ice in Siberia's tundra was covered with grass, and that grass was grazed by large animals, Pleistocene animals, horses, ox, mammoth, all that stuff. And as those animals were lost in that area, it converted over to moss. And that moss doesn't insulate the ground as well as the grass. So the tundra is now melting. And when it melts, it releases these huge carbon stores. And so that's adding to the greenhouse effect. So because of huge concern over global warming, greenhouse effect, they started looking at this problem and they're like, well, what we're missing here are the Pleistocene era grazers that used to sustain the system. So now they are reintroducing horse and oxen back into the area and bison, hoping to restore the grassland and buy some time. I mean, they don't, with global warming, it'll eventually melt, but they're hoping that reintroduction of this grassland system will buy time for...
cut down on the amount of methane being released. I know I've spent a lot of time out in the Midwest and in the plains before you get to the Rockies. From my experience, I know one time we camped on some BLM land, and it took us more than a half hour to kick all the cactus out of an area about 10 feet by 10 feet, because that's all that was growing out there on this land was cactus and scrub. And you really had to look hard to find any grass on the grasslands out there. If you went out and looked around, the highest thing you would find in the area was cactus, you know, and that was only a few inches tall, prickly pear cactus, which is pretty when it's blooming, but there was nothing left out there from what they say was grass up to the height of a saddle when a horse rode through there. And now there's really nothing left.
And Donlin et al., they blame that encroachment of those cactus and woody plants on the lack of elephants.
Yeah.
And the elephants actually kept all those woody plants at bay and the grasslands more uniform. So, interesting.
Yeah, that whole area is really so ecologically impoverished. But there's still pronghorn that run around out in the grasslands.
And how fast do they run?
They run faster than my dog. Because my dog tried to catch one day, and she actually got run over by one. She got close enough that they ran into her. I don't think they saw her. They saw us, and they were running in a big arc away from us. So she cut them off at the pass, and I thought she was, you know, she'd been killed, but they just ran right over her. So they were fast.
Pronghorn run over 60 miles an hour.
Wow.
There's no reason now why pronghorn should run that fast. The reason why they run that fast is that they're evolved to outrun cheetahs.
Wow.
And now that's just a remnant from when the cheetah was its predator 10,000 years ago. So there's these footprints left still of these large Pleistocene-era animals that were on the landscape that now it's sort of like an appendix. They don't need it anymore. They don't need to go that fast.
They don't.
So how is an African cheetah or an elephant going to survive the plains on Turtle Island where it gets really cold and nasty in the winter?
Well, I think that the idea is to have this go all the way into Canada and all the way on down into Mexico. So
that those animals that they brought in from Africa would be kept in the south, southwest?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Yeah.
Like you
because
were saying.
Because the elephants don't have the woolly, you know, like the woolly mammoth.
Yeah,
they don't have
right.
the overcoat. All right.
Let's do a song about America by the Reagan Babies.
just bought his way into space.
Last week, Science Times had a big story, front page story, and a full page inside, which is a really good one, on a wildlife corridor basically in the Rockies that does go from Yellowstone all the way up to the Yukon to the Alaskan border. And it's a large area. I don't know. I can't remember how many millions of acres, but it's a lot of land. It's really in the same vein as what we're talking about. It's a large, intact habitat that will keep a lot of species from going extinct, because the projection is that many of these large species are on their way out. Grizzly bears, all the bears really, are in big trouble. Black bears in this part of the country seem to be doing better, but they're small. They're very small, and they're getting smaller.
But in relation to what Jennifer's talking about, those corridors are unfenced. Talk about controversy.
Yeah. I think this one out there, they're talking about it being big enough so that the habitat would be varied enough and that there would be natural ways for the animals to stay in their habitat. They wouldn't be moving into agricultural areas, a lot of these animals.
In this discussion of the Pleistocene Park, I mean, it's definitely starting off fenced, and maybe as the public becomes more at ease with what's happening, maybe then it could go into a more natural, unfenced-like setting. But this definitely brings up one of the key things for the public to discuss is, what kind of natural world do we want? Are we willing to live with large predators? And how important are those predators? And science has certainly found a lot of cases where these predators are key to the entire balance of the ecosystem. And things like the deer are a perfect example of things getting out of whack when the predator is, you know, lost.
Yeah. The only check we have on deer here in the East really is hunting. And each year there are fewer and fewer hunters.
Well, each year there are more. The suburbs grow larger. And
yep.
And development.
The people are encroaching on deer habitat and planting shrubbery for the deer to eat.
Yes.
And another good example of that is the loss of whales, which is from human overkill. When we lost a lot of whales, we forced killer whales, who used to eat gray whales, to turn to smaller prey, like sea otters and seals, sea lions, which caused their numbers to plummet. And we actually lost sea otters because the killer whales turned to them and we were exploiting them. And because of that, the sea urchins, their prey increase, and they reduce the kelp beds, which in turn ruins our food supply, fish whose estuaries are in kelp beds. So, you know, this linkage between the predators and their prey and the food web idea is something most people don't think about when they think, well, I don't want a cheetah in my backyard. That's a crazy idea. But what are the ramifications of losing large predators? And what are you willing to live with? And, you know, what kind of landscape do you want? So what kind of flora and fauna?
Well, we do have some things making a comeback in the East here. The moose is making a big comeback. And that would be an example, a large vertebrate animal that was totally gone from
this
area.
Bears too, yeah.
They have made a huge comeback. Sunday we were out tracking some moose in Leverett, so there are definitely moose living all around us. They're coming into towns now.
There's one in our backyard. Right down by
occasionally they come go shopping here at Thorne's Market.
There was an article in the New York Times today or yesterday about bears and moose and stuff coming within close proximity of the city. And the article, in my interpretation, was very fear-inducing.
Yeah, it was.
Uh-huh. There's going to be bears prowling in your garbage on New York City street. That's just so classic, this misunderstanding of predators and our interactions with them and what level we're willing to interact with them. And it's interesting public discussion, I think.
Right. Well, correct me if I'm wrong. A lot of that is a result of what used to be farmland reverting to woodlands. And so the bear and the moose range out into the woodlands.
Yeah.
But now with the, what is it, ex-urban development, people who want to move out of the suburbs or the city and move into the exurbs find the bears in their bird feeders, whatnot. I was thinking when you were talking about the whales, I read in Sea Shepherd Conservation Society magazine about the drop in the krill population and how that affects the whales that feed on krill. So all these things are connected. It's mind-boggling. But I guess it's all been thrown off by the human population, right?
Absolutely. We have an unbelievable footprint on this planet, and we have to think about the ramifications of our actions and, you know, what kind of planet do we want? What kind of ecosystems do we want to have around? Are we willing to live with and willing to compromise to obtain?
One article that you've got, Glenn Times, has...
Last week's Science Times.
Yeah. Where is it?
It's right there.
It's got overpasses, wildlife overpasses going over the highway that...
Here's my feeling about the interstate highway system, the biggest environmental disaster ever done to this country. They should have had wildlife biologists, conservation biologists. Maybe they weren't around then. But anyway, they should have been there, and they should have gone out and studied the land and looked to see where all the animal migratory routes were and where the deer trails were. And then wherever there was one of those, they should have taken care of that first and either put the highway underneath those areas of concentrated animal use, or they should have built these kinds of overpasses that they're showing for interstates. And in some cases, they just should not have had roads in those areas. The road should have been somewhere else. This whole concept of just put a road through and let the animals take their chances crossing it is one of the hugest disasters on wildlife that this country has. You know, millions and millions of animals are killed every day on the road system. I guess when we pray for industrial collapse, that'll maybe be the first thing that goes is the car.
The listeners want to check this out. It's fascinating. What, 2-3 page New York Times Tuesday, May 23rd feature. And it's got a picture of this overpass. It's like hills, two hills going over a interstate highway with all kinds of trees and whatnot on it. It's fascinating. They also have underpasses, but there's no flags hanging from this overpass. That's a problem, I think.
Yeah. Well, they could get a permit for that, maybe.
Yeah.
But one of the things they say in that article is that underpasses and overpasses attract different animals or are used by different animals. So bears, for instance, grizzly bears want to have open space because they're the kings. And they'll go over the overpass, but black bears will look for a secluded area to travel. And they'll go in an underpass, for instance. And some wolves will go over an overpass and some will go under. So there has to be a lot of thought put into these things. But it makes sense from a public safety standpoint, because how many people are killed by hitting moose and other things? And that is just going to increase as wildlife makes a comeback, hopefully. But the whole concept about back to the Pleistocene has really brought up an issue of what are we trying to save? What are we spending a lot of time trying to save, like snail darters, for instance, or some species that doesn't have a huge ecological impact? And would it be better to be protecting these large flagship or keystone species that require huge amounts of habitat? And when we save those with large habitats, are we also saving a lot of these small three-spired toothed snail or whatever one you want to think of? And what do you think about that, Jennifer?
Well, I think that's a critically important thing to consider. Definitely major theory in conservation biology is if you save these large in terms of territory and top species in terms of being the predators, that you're going to save everybody underneath, the trickle-down theory, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that. That corridor that you just showed me in that New York Times article there for the large bear and moose populations, that's going to save a lot of other animals that those bear, moose all interact with. I joke around to my friends all the time, all of this research is good and well, but really the money should be spent on just buying land, lots of land, and setting aside the space that these animals need over the time period that they need them, and preserving the ecological processes and the evolutionary potential for these species. And these large preserves and park systems and corridor systems for these large animals definitely gets at preserving ecological process and function.
I think a big thing is the actual evolution of vertebrate
Absolutely.
Mammals and other species. And I remember seeing Dave Foreman talk about, well, I don't want to say how long ago, many years ago, and he had the audience crying at one point because he convinced us all that for all intents and purposes, vertebrate evolution has ended. And it's a very sobering thought to think that the humans have stopped evolution in its tracks for the most part. The large animals are really no longer evolving. They're stuck, they're declining, they've gone through tremendous bottlenecks, and whether they're going to recover is really questionable. Do they have the genetic base to do that? And I think thinking big is what it requires, because our approach to conservation has been very myopic, and we have to really think big. That's what this idea is. It's a really huge thought. And that's, I think, why people are, some people are opposed to it, because they're used to thinking on a much smaller scale.
Well, and a lot of people don't care. So if this involves any kind of government funding or anything, it's not like decade or longer ago when folks considered how many, 75-80% of the people in this country considered themselves environmentalists. That's history. It isn't that way anymore. People probably don't care about this. So I would imagine for it to happen, there would either have to be industrial collapse, or there'd have to be a big change in the mindset of the average.
Well, that's why we're looking at a 50-year program here,
yes.
Because it's going to take
some private land and private funding.
Right. It is going to take a long time to educate people.
It's hard for me, the educated biologist, to get my head around the time scale and the spatial scale that you need to protect the evolutionary potential of species. Basically, the human vision and understanding of the world is during your lifetime, right? Or our collective memories, which is not a very long time evolutionarily.
No.
So it's very hard to get your head around that.
Yep.
And we have to think much broader scales than we have been up until this point.
Even the native concept of thinking seven generations into the future is really, that's not long enough for evolution to really be occurring. When a lot of species, endangered species, are managed now, they're managed from the brink until they're just barely off of the brink of collapse or the brink of extinction, and then they're delisted. Maybe there's 1,000 individuals or 2,000 and they feel that that's an adequate population. But no, this concept of back to the Pleistocene is that it's not just an adequate number, it's a number that will continue forever into the future, even during a glacial retreat or a glacial advance, even during global warming, for instance. These species will be able to adapt over a time period that stretches out into the next epoch, whatever it is.
Well, this is a fascinating, mind-boggling subject, I must say. Jennifer, will you come back?
Yeah, absolutely.
Progress report.
There is a lot of information to read, and we did put a link on our web blog.
It's true, and that's at www.enviroshow.blogspot.com. And you can also leave your comments there. Again, www.enviroshow.blogspot.com. Next up is Sleep Well and Pleasant Dreams for all you kiddies. Also check out Vegan Radio every other Thursday at noon. And, of course, our sister show, Farm to Fork, will be on next week. So thanks again, Jennifer, for coming in.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
This is Dio saying so long.
And this is Glenn Ayers signing off.
We're going out with Naked in the Rain by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. This is a Back to the Pleistocene song, if ever there was one.